tidal power.
Radio EcoShock.
This is what it's all about. The moon and the planets in the solar system act on the oceans of the planet and cause the water column to raise, and then as the planet spins around, these cycle in and out to the continents and the inlets, and you get the inrushing tides. Globally, there's sufficient tidal resources to probably power the world's needs one or two times over, maybe even three times.
Hi there, this is Alex. Whenever politicians and Greens talk about alternative energy, the list usually goes wind, solar, and tidal power. But how real is tidal power? Where will it happen and when? This week on Radio EcoShock, you'll hear Martin Berger, CEO of a tidal power company called Blue Energy. He spoke to the New Energy Movement in Vancouver on January 26, 2009. In fact, Martin went further. He explained four other neglected energy sources, the best and the most intriguing, from a survey of 500 he's examined over the past two decades. I'll add those as time allows. And as promised, in last week's show, we'll consider how new ways of living appear in a society. Berger says money cannot bring the next wave. It is a problem of consciousness, how we function as big groups, like the flocks and schools of other animals. Along the way, I'll toss in a few facts about installations around the world, the current state of tidal power. How about this one? Did you know that days used to be much shorter here on Earth? Like 21.9 hours a day, just 620 million years ago, instead of 24. Just pumping all that seawater into the bays and narrows of the world uses up mechanical energy that causes the world to spin. The tides are slowing down the planet. The 26-hour day is coming, but don't toss out your clocks just yet. That will be another 600 million years from now. As we'll hear from Martin Berger, this immense power can be harnessed to create giant streams of electricity. The initial building cost is high, but the long-term maintenance costs are quite low. The impact on the local ecology varies with the design, and people are working on that. Martin will be describing a tidal fence of spinning rotors built into a bridge, perhaps. It's a big dream, but there are signs tidal power is beginning to lift off in various parts of the world. Now I'm going to pick out the tidal info from Martin's speech at Simon Fraser University, Vancouver.
I'm happy to see that there are some curious minds in Vancouver and that our attention, and this is important because our attention must turn to going beyond switching the light on when we walk in the room to taking the responsibility for our energy usage and our energy choices and which of those choices are included in the mix. For if we fail to do that, things will just continue as they are and much as they've been for the whole century. One would think that after 100 years of invention and energy researchers know the names very well, Victor Schauberger that was just mentioned, Nikola Tesla, to name a few. There are many others, but And most of those are ridiculed as kooks and wacky inventors that really didn't know good science. Well, I've been in the space now for some 25 years and have now vetted probably over 500 emerging energy technologies. And there are a lot of inventions. There's been a lot of astute observations made in nature and in physics. It's become apparent, in spite of the so-called academic authorities that will still jump up today, and I'm sure they're lurking around the doors of this auditorium even this evening, waiting for somebody to suggest there's something out there akin to what they scornfully describe as a perpetual motion device. And I think it's time we illuminated that space, given now we've had 100 years of this nonsensical noise, a noise that's prevented us from achieving sustainable energy goals and, in fact, low-cost clean energy. And when we talk about the problems in physics, these authorities stand up and they quickly cite the first and second law of thermodynamics. But what they forget to cite is also the footnote for both of those, and which describes the energy going into a system and what you're able to get out of it. And basically, if you suggest that you're getting more energy out of a particular situation, this is heresy, scientific heresy. Well, it's time to see that that authoritative position is too heresy as well. Heresy in that I challenge any of these scientific authorities in physics today to show me a system that is closed. When we have a reality model that is yet to integrate quantum mechanics, gravity, and electromagnetism, and God knows what else, this is a very limited view of nature and of reality. And for somebody to suggest that they've got an authoritative and definitive position on something like the first and second law of thermodynamics and the great work that's been achieved this century by the Schaubergers and Nikola Tesla and many others, I think it's time that people take this to heart. And if a device works, then it's the onus and the responsibility for us to determine how it works, not to decide it shouldn't work and so therefore to turn our back on it. And what I've seen this century, I've become a student of innovation, is that there are indeed technologies that have been stranded. The one that really brought this to mind was Barry Davis's work. And my founding partner, Barry Davis, was an aerospace engineer going back to the Avro Aero aircraft project that Canada built. This was a supersonic jet fighter that would fly at Mach 3 speeds in 1959. Cutting-edge technology, and nobody can say today that that airplane didn't fly, and it would outfly the F-18 Hornet today in speed, altitude, and range, and payload, and rate of climb, and rate of acceleration. So these inventors have done their job, and the authorities, for various reasons, primarily vested interest reasons, have done everything they can to discourage their development. I know of 10 or 12 systems today that would change the world as we know it for the better in a very short period of time. And all they cost is about a measly $10 million a piece to get the science and the physics straightened out, to get a beta unit and perhaps an alpha unit and a beta unit out and commercialize the thing and get it up to scale. These are very minuscule amounts. This is talking about rounding errors for a company like Exxon or British Petroleum. And we hear the public spin that, you know, BP is going green. But when you look at it, it's just totally insignificant. And also, in spite of what Mr. Brown has said, I also say totally insincere. So these inventions have languished for most of the century. And when they could have been employed and used to the benefit of us all, The technology that group that interests me is what I call the beneficial, scalable, stranded technology cluster. And these technologies can make a difference in a short period of time, but we have to work together with organizations like the New Energy Movement, and we need to get the information out on the internet and YouTube it and do whatever it takes. But there needs to be a certain level of consciousness before this future will be available to us. Money, technology, organizational development, all of these things are essential, and they will be brought to bear, and they will work in due course. So we do, in fact, have a clean, low-cost energy solution at our fingertips. It's been at our fingertips for 100 years or more. Many solutions. I've looked at now, I think I said 500, and I've looked at probably 50 more of them today in preparation for this presentation tonight. And it is a shame, it is a bloody shame, that these men and women have labored and worked, and in many cases, given their lives and expired their lives in pursuit of this sustainable energy, low-cost future that's been denied humanity. So it's time to get a little upset and register the fact that you know the gig is up, and work together, network together, to bring these solutions into the public domain where they're challenged. Yes, they should all be challenged. They should be rigorously tested, but they have to be put up and tested before we will ever realize the benefits of that. Now, tonight, I will talk about my story with Blue Energy and some of the work that we're doing to commercialize the Davis turbine. Barry Davis passed away, regrettably. He worked some 35, 40 years, and long before I met him, on this work, and had in fact given up. He'd got to a place of disillusionment, frustration, and futility at great cost and sacrifice to his family. And I was naive at the time, thinking that, oh, I'll help him along, and in 3-4 months, we'll have this job done. And that was almost 20 years ago, coming up this July. So this is a job. It's not for the faint-hearted, but I grew up in the Arctic, and at 50 below, we didn't learn the word quit. For if you quit up there in 20 minutes, you were a popsicle. So this is something that we never did up there. And when I take on a job, I'll finish it. And I intend to finish this one if it takes me 25 or 50 years. I could give it good goddamn. That's just how it is. This job is going to get done. So I'll talk about Blue Energy tonight. It's a simple, elegant technology solution. The David Suzuki Foundation supported it through the efforts of Jim Fulton. Jim Fulton just recently passed away here in December of this year, another great figure in sustainability and advocacy for justice for the community. Jim Fulton was one of the first people that recognized this effort and lobbied on our behalf in Ottawa many years ago. And as a result, there was some federal funding that was put to work with the National Research Council. And now there's been a cumulative 115 man-years that have gone into the Davis turbine. There is no other tidal power technology out there that will provide what this solution does, Blue Energy. There's no one that's been more rigorously tested and examined and better understood in those 115 man-years. This technology could provide a transportation link between Vancouver and Vancouver Island. And in the presentation tonight, I will show you the bridge, the Confederation Bridge. And if the potato farmers of Prince Edward Island can get it together to build themselves a bridge to hook to Canada, surely Vancouver and British Columbia could do the same. Now, Blue Energy has spent an enormous amount of time and money in business development in many places around the world, and I'll go into a bit of that tonight. Our order book is now in excess, pre-commercial still, but in excess of some $30 billion. This is unprecedented. Tell me a dot-com technology that's achieved an order book of $500 million before their commercial debut. Blue Energy is now in excess of $30 billion. So when this does go, it will go very big and go rapidly. After the Blue Energy portion of the presentation tonight, I'll talk to you about 3 or 4 other technologies that I've been watching, networking with, talking to the inventors and the developers, and these are no-brainers.
that is Martin Berger from www.blueenergy.com. In this Radio EcoShock special on tidal power, we're going to skip ahead now to what we came for. More on this powerful green energy source from Martin's speech to the New Energy Movement Canada in January 2009.
So with that, I will step into the Blue Energy PowerPoint presentation and go through that and then address some of these other technologies. This is what it's all about, in that the moon and the planets in the solar system act on the oceans of the planet and cause the water column to raise, and then as the planet spins around, these cycle in and out of the continents and the inlets, and you get the inrushing tides. The tides are predictable. We know the moon, when it goes around, when the tides move, when it comes out there. They plot these tables 10, 20 years in advance. And so it becomes a very predictable, high-density resource. And if you compare it to the wind and photovoltaics, their resource densities typically range in the 1,000 kilowatts per square meter per annum to 1,100. Whereas Blue Energy's technology with the tidal resources can range in excess of 200,000. So 200 times the energy density, the extraction efficiencies are double, the scalability is quadruple. So those are the reasons. I've been told those are the drivers, but they're not drivers until they actually drive you somewhere. They're good reasons why we should be investigating this space, and at some point they will in fact become market drivers. The technology can be used at the micro scale. We've had eight small prototypes, including now some 12 or 1300 tow tank trial experiments, confirming our numeric models in our optimization program at UBC. And water is 800 plus times as dense as air, and 8-knot current is equivalent to about 400 kilometers per hour wind speed. It's a vertical axis architecture and configuration, a lift-driven design. This is not a drag where the water pushes against it. It creates a negative vacuum, and the foils are pulled faster than, in fact, the speed of the water. The string is removable. There's no underwater service required of any of the components. This is a nice little 20 kilowatt. It was designed for 20. We thought it would produce 25. It actually produced 42. And this was at Cornwall, Ontario, way back in 1984. Blue Energy, after Nova Energy and a couple other companies before that, was founded in 1997. The company was registered in BC and Alberta. We've raised and put about $9 million into the program to date. John here has said five, but I think we're now at about eight. The last was a 1 kilowatt model at UBC. On the right, you see the top right, a 100 kilowatt device that was tested at the foot of a dam in Sheet Harbor, Nova Scotia. And the tow tank in the middle, in the carriage there, towing our device, is at the hydraulics lab at UBC. And that funky little graphic at the bottom is some of the numeric modeling that we've done in our optimization program. We've taken a lot of pains and computer time to replicate our theoretical position on the device and then verified it numerically with results from the tank. So we've got a design confidence now where we can proceed very rapidly and quickly through the 150 scale-up ratios that remain before us to get to ocean-class scale. This is some of the numeric modeling. I think there's about 30,000 nodal points in a 2D slice of the rotor assembly area. You can see the different pressures, positive to the negative, around the foils. And there it's rocking back and forth as the velocities come up, and you'll see it at one point self-start. It's cross-flow design. The center shaft is not in the numeric model at this point. And there you see the stream acting on the front and the rear foil. You're getting a resultant vector starting to form now. And then it starts. And then you can see how these vortices and resultant vectors drive the Davis turbine design. There's a tidal bridge ultimately at the end of this technology scale up, and you'll see a tidal bridge at some point between Vancouver and Vancouver Island. And there's probably 25,000 megawatts available. And instead of waiting for 3-4 hours in July and August when all the tourists overwhelm us and our ferry infrastructure, you'll be across there in 25-30 minutes. 25,000 megawatts is a lot of power that would pay for social programs, reduce the tax burden of British Columbians, and create probably in excess of 50,000 jobs, forward-looking jobs, jobs that your children and grandchildren would be honored and happy to have, high-paying jobs, as we propagate this technology, firstly to the energy-hungry Pacific Rim markets. And globally, there's sufficient tidal resources to probably power the world's needs one or two times over, maybe even three times. The existing design is good for about 200 feet. I envision it at some point would be good for up to 600 feet. It's a modular design, thin shell concrete marine caisson construction. Basically, it's all known construction methodology. And the company's filing a provisional patent on the tidal bridge design with 21 patent claims. Here you can see there's stacked modules and a low-profile bridge crossing at the top. What I wanted to show you was the dramatic power of the tides. There's a standing wave in the Pentland Firth, and we're out there in a zodiac, and it's very dramatic. And at about 6 meters, 5 to 6 meters a second, you're talking a wind force equivalent in excess of 1,000 kilometers per hour wind speed. So this is a hugely rich, dense resource. And we've got similar resources here on the west coast of British Columbia and up into Alaska. Here's the hatch to remove the rotor strings right from the bottom bearing. Embedded roadway tunnels. This one was designed for San Bernardino Strait in the Philippines, where you've got typhoon winds, and this structure will sustain 150 mile an hour typhoon winds in its design, the storm surge.
Next, Martin gives a description of his company members and his backing, and it does sound impressive, but we're going to skip ahead again and go to where they're working in the world and how it's going. In fact, during the question and answer period, I asked Martin Berger of Blue Energy, where is this actually being built? What's really happening? Because I had a feel it was all experimental. And at first in his answer, I thought he was putting me off. He gave me a speech about 100 monkeys, and then he did give me some details. But in fact, I think he went deep into the reason why alternative energy has been so slow to catch on.
The Japanese biologists in their monkey cluster work in the South Japanese Islands learned when they taught a few of the monkeys to wash their fruit. The monkeys would be up in the tree, knock the fruit down, but then pick it up and it was soiled. So the young gal thought, well, it'd be interesting if I could teach this intelligent monkey how to wash the fruit. So she took it to the stream, and the monkey very quickly got the idea, wash the fruit. Well, we can empirically and logically ascertain from the observation how all this occurs is transference, the observation. Other monkeys learned it, and then pretty soon that whole cluster had the habit. That's all understandable under sort of the conventional perspective. But we have yet to integrate quantum mechanics, holographic field, non-local effect. It's on the blackboard since the 20s, but it's got to make it to the kitchen table and be integrated in our lives. Okay? Now, the monkeys started washing fruit on adjacent islands with nobody to teach them or no other monkeys to observe. So it became known in the lexicon as the 100th monkey. Okay? Blue Energy achieves 40,000, 50,000 hits per month on our website. that one factor is more important than the technology, the science, the numerics, the corporate organizational development, the commitment, even the integrity of the participants. Okay? That consciousness driver, when we get our 100th monkey, that $30 billion order book is going to come alive very quickly. So we're at a very interesting stage at Blue Energy. We've got tons of interest coming at us all over the world. And we're looking for what constitutes an enabling field. I could use a couple million dollars today. I could use $50 million and ultimately $200 million. But more important than the money is that process. And to get the enabling field around this opportunity. And when that last monkey gets on our what could be train, it's going to be a lot of fun. So I see that monkey getting on in India, Indonesia, New Zealand, Scotland, or Chile, perhaps even Korea. We've got a bit of a cultural language issue that doesn't really lend itself to a small capitalization effort like ours in a place like Korea, but it is still a very rich environment. There's two places that are right now the epicenters in marine energy propagation and development and interest and awareness, and one is Scotland and the UK, and the other is Korea. But there are strategic alliance partners recognizing this at the visceral level now that's never been achieved in my 20-some years in it. Okay, these were always interesting conversations. You go to Calgary and talk to an oil company, and you have a nice guy, smart, well-educated, understands basic science and physics, could understand what I was excited about. But it was all said and done. He didn't viscerally get it. This was just something that spun up here. It didn't come and get him down here. And there are strategic alliance partners in places that are showing a sensitivity. And wherever you go, you've got oligarchies in control of the energy game. Every jurisdiction, we've all heard about the Russian oligarchies and how they run the oil and the natural gas and Gazprom and Russia. Well, believe me, here in BC, we've got energy oligarchies, okay? They make the decisions at BC Hydro. Gordon Campbell doesn't make them. Mossadegh, Umadali don't make them. They're just figureheads. There are people behind the scenes that control this, and they've got a death grip on it, okay? Well, there are other jurisdictions where there are factors coming to bear on that oligarchy control and have a sensitivity to invention, innovation, and opportunity that doesn't exist here. Washington State would make the most sense from an empirical level. All those aerospace engineers and scientists at Boeing and all these aircraft design people, perfect talent pool. Puget Sound, 10,000, 12,000 megawatts at Admiralty Inlet. U.S. Navy wanting to work with Penn State University and Blue Energy. All of those things would, you know, you'd think that that would be one of the natural places to seat this technology and create that enabling field. Never happened.
That's Martin Berger from Blue Energy. We're talking tidal power on Radio EcoShock. We'll be back in less than 1 minute with a lot more on what's going on around the world with green tidal power.
And the sea is rising and rising and rising, then it falls. Nothing stays the same.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking tidal power. Coming up, we'll have more from Martin Berger as he addresses the New Energy Movement Canada, with good technologies languishing under the regime of oil and coal. First, I'd like to take a quick spin around the world to find tidal power in action. As any Google search will tell you, humans have been harnessing the tides since ancient times. The Romans did it, and so did people in medieval Europe, even making tidal rotors to drive grain mills. We could still drive machinery with the tides, but the real goal now is electricity, and lots of it. Basically, at least three kinds of tide machines have been built, at least in prototypes. Case one, there are barricades which allow the tides in and then hold the water back for gradual release through the turbines. They're almost like dams. These are the most ecologically damaging to build and operate. We can look at one of the first real commercial tidal plants built on the Rance River in France back in 1966. To build it, the engineers had to construct two dams on either side of the site, completely blocking the river for a long time. Some species died off to be replaced by others after the river flow was somewhat restored. The project was expensive for the time, but over the following decades, it has proved very cheap to maintain. The Rance River tidal project more than paid back its cost in electricity generated, but most of us would find the ecological costs too high to bear. Martin Berger's designs are a second case, which are called tidal fences. They do not require a complete dam of the local water flows. The electricity is only generated about 18 hours a day. That's because there are two high tides and two low in each 24-hour period, with about an hour and a half of slack tide, the time when the water isn't moving much either way. Still, with tidal tables, this slack time is predictable years in advance, and tidal power is much more stable than either wind or solar, which can vary very much with the weather. The least ecologically damaging proposals call for the equivalent of wind turbines built on the shallow ocean floors, fueled by the tides. These would not be visible on the surface. Proponents of both tidal fences and turbines claim that neither marine mammals nor fish would be hurt by these installations. Berger said the rotors move slowly enough that fish find the equivalent of a revolving door to a department store. Even larger fish like salmon can maneuver their way through, he says, but during a major run the rotors could be shut down. There are also plans to let both ships and large mammals pass through specifically designed locks located near the normal traffic ways. I don't know enough to judge these claims, and the ecological impact of tidal power is still being studied in various labs and universities. There is a worry about imposing our energy needs on the sea. What are the unforeseen impacts? Still, the vision of using the tides instead of wrecking the atmosphere with carbon seems very promising to me. Where is it? There are only about 40 places in the world where the tides are strong enough to generate economic power. These have been pretty well mapped out, at least for existing tech. The United States has fewer tidal opportunities than Canada, the UK, Russia, or even Australia. Frankly, there isn't much tide power going on in the U.S. right now. As my San Francisco listeners know, there has been a proposal to harness the tides running under the Golden Gate Bridge. The plan has stalled so far for lack of funding, but it might happen if financing and approvals show up. There has been a prototype running since 2007 in the East River in New York City. The blades of the first model broke off, but a stronger version was installed in September 2008. There is another test of a prototype near Eastport, Maine. We've already heard about proposals to install tide turbines on Canada's west coast and Puget Sound in the U.S. The famous Bay of Fundy on Canada's east coast is also a good contender. Oh yeah, and the Nova Scotia Power Corporation opened the Annapolis Royal Generating Station back in 1984. A company called Marine Current Turbines has installed a big 1-megawatt-plus generator at Strangford Lough in North Ireland. The Wikipedia entry for tidal power says this is the first commercial-scale device installed anywhere in the world. But the installation in the Rance River, spelled R-A-N-C-E, France, it was built decades before that. Dr. A.M. Gorlov is offering a helical rotor-type tide generator. Martin Berger disputes the originality of this design, which is entering a pilot project in South Korea now. Gorlov has also claimed that turbines running in the Gulf Stream could power all of North America. Russia claims a 12-megawatt tidal project is being constructed at Kislyaguba with orthogonal turbines. China is experimenting with tide projects, both large and small. There was also a commercial scale of tidal power in Australia off the Gold Coast of Queensland in 2002. The government also plans a combination desalinization and tidal power demonstration near Brisbane. Many other countries, from Norway through Italy to New Zealand, are seriously considering tidal power or already experimenting with it. But other than the Northern Ireland installation, I think it's fair to say we don't yet have a big tidal generating station operating anywhere in the world. It's not vaporware, but tidal power isn't something we can rely on in the short term, unless climate change and energy prices drive governments and corporations into more serious action. That leads back to the question asked by many, including Senator John Kerry to Al Gore in his January Senate testimony: why haven't these alternative energies really taken off? Yes, there has been a solid block of lobby money, well, endless lobby money, from the old oil, gas, and coal industries, but there could be more to this. We don't yet understand what makes humans, all of us, change. So before we examine some of the other technical contenders for better energy, with more from Martin Berger, let's listen again to last week's clip. Berger calls on the vision of Einstein that everything is really a field of frozen or slowed energy. You and I are fields of atoms that are somehow held together in a field, and collectively we interact to project a much larger field into time, into the future. I want to hear that one again.
And this is a long talk in of itself, and we are in the infancy of our consciousness evolution as individuals, but in this collective mind field, okay? Our Western perspective has not or has failed to integrate the quantum perspective and field effect. There is a fundamental truth in physics and in reality to what Chief Seattle said when he talked about the web of life and how all the animal kingdom, the birds, the forests, the beasts, and all of us are all connected at some dimensional root level. And out of that arises a signal that generates and manifests our shared experience called our future. And if you haven't contemplated the possibility of a low-cost, clean, sustainable energy future, that signal is presently weak, and that signal is displaced and dominated by those with an agenda that serves a narrow element and segment rather than the broader segment of society. So consciousness is really more important in creating this future and in realizing the opportunities of significant efforts that have come long before this one. But this one is still under the same limits of a feeble signal to the future. Okay? Meetings like this, your book, your effort, the new energy movement creates that monkey that has to ride that what could be train. And every one of these efforts needs that 100th monkey. So they will behave quantumly until that quantum mass is achieved in attention and consciousness. But then there's a tipping point where they can't be stopped. So money won't do it. Money will take, and you can put something into a technology and have a great flurry go on. But if it's going to change the world, it has to occur with consciousness before the money will make it stick. So there are other technologies out there raising more money, but when you look at it from a vision versus a good idea, most of them are just good ideas. They're not going to change the future. They don't have a future.
So, my friends, all the money in the world, even from Obama's dream, isn't likely to bring us tidal power and other significant energy changes unless you and I can envision this sustainable future. Until we have the experience of that 100th monkey, the turning tide in the minds of millions of humans. I believe it can happen, even though we don't yet understand how. Someday, no matter what troubles arise, our energy will be drawn from the pull of the sun and the moon on our oceans. I know it. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock, We'll continue now with more from Martin Berger, CEO of Blue Energy, a tidal power company. Speaking to the New Energy Movement Canada, Berger explores the top tier of almost lost energy alternatives that he's encountered over the past couple of decades. This is from a seeker who looked pretty well under every stone for energy answers.
In addition to the quasi-turbine, one that I've recently come across is called the Mighty Engine, MYT device. This little engine won a multi-million dollar prize from NASA as a change the world technology recently. I don't fully understand it. I haven't seen detailed drawings, but what I see I really like. And the fact that it's been vetted at the level that it has, I'm confident that it will in time prove out to be something as spectacular and beneficial as the potential in the quasi-turbine. Stanley Myers is another name that's almost as famous as the Nikola Tesla, the Victor Schaubergers, at least in our small engineering research, innovation, energy research community. Stanley Myers wasn't a physicist or a chemist or an engineer. He was a layperson, but he was very creative, and he came up with a water fuel cell, basically with an onboard alternator in a Volkswagen, four-cylinder, air-cooled Volkswagen dune buggy, was able to power enough oxygen or hydroxy or Brown's gas, pick the name, one of the above, to power this little dune buggy to run solely on water. And he said it would take 22 gallons of water to drive from New York to Los Angeles. And that technology kind of got waylaid when he was whacked. His brother claimed that he was poisoned, and he was meeting with nefarious characters of the U.S. military leading up to his demise. And there is speculation, no proof, but speculation that his untimely demise was part of an obstruction effort. There have been many stories about men in black, if you would, and obstructed inventors. Gene Manning's friend, John Hutchison, with his Hutchison effect, has had his laboratory raised a number of times, equipment stolen, this sort of thing. Well, Stanley Myers' dune buggy disappeared as well just shortly after his death. His laboratory was ransacked and the dune buggy disappeared. This was an interesting story in that his patent expired last June. And we've had probably 2,000 or 3,000 garage efforts going on around the world to replicate his circuit diagram. So I shared the story of Stanley Myers with Mitchell, and he was of a traditional or a conservative engineering background and thought that I had slipped a cog, or maybe that I was a bit wacky when I suggested that Stanley was achieving 1,700% output of his input from his water fuel cell device. Now, go back to these authorities in physics and the first and second law of thermodynamics, and theoretically, you could probably get close to point, you know, or to one, you know, 0.95, 0.98. But if you go to 1,700, you're clearly a heretic. Well, my friend Mitch started out with that view, and it took me 3 years to school him in alternative energy, the likes of Tom Bearden, the great Colonel Tom Bearden's work, many other inventors. Joseph Tills, again, will be talking about Schauberger's work here in February, and I encourage everybody to come out and listen to Joseph. Joseph's a fascinating individual. But Mitch was 3 years comprehending that this might be feasible and possible. That dune buggy went down the road with only water on a 35-amp alternator. How is it in classical physics you can get enough hydrogen separation at about a 75% extraction efficiency to power the fuel needs of an internal combustion engine of 2,000 cc? Well, under conventional thinking in physics, this is impossible. But Stanley Myers did do it, so it lives there as a fact. You could say that he had a hidden fuel bottle under the car and stuff like that, but that's nonsense. That didn't go on. Stanley was an upstanding regular guy. It would be a very productive exercise to talk to these other two fellas that have got it and have basically been bought off. The one of them has clearly indicated a willingness to see this technology out there for the greater good. So at some point, he will certainly spill the beans if one of us doesn't nail the frequency that will release this flood of hydrogen or Brown's gas or hydroxy. And hydroxy is said to be hydrogen at the atomic level. And most of our understanding of hydrogen is at the molecular level. So there's something going on, gating, if you would, through the zero point in this process. If you look at conventional electrolysis, the grade 9 science project where you separate water into hydrogen and oxygen, you'll get these little bubbles coming off your anodes. But when you look at the video of Stanley Myers' fuel cell, he has a container, looks like a water filter canister, and it literally just boils off very large volumes of hydroxyhydrogen gas. So I could understand with what you see visually coming off of that canister that that would be enough to power an internal combustion engine. So at some point in our lifetime, we will stand with our garden hose in the driveway and fill these SUVs and these automobiles. The Wankel was an interesting little concept engine developed by Mazda. General Motors put probably $50 million into the Wankel. They solved the seal problems that plagued the development in its early days, but weren't able to achieve efficient combustion or high enough compression pressures that coincided with the introduction of emissions requirements, more stringent emission requirements. And so the Wankel died a death, and the quasi-turbine achieves all of the promise that the Wankel promised and wasn't able to achieve, and avoids a lot of the drawbacks. It's got, rather than the Wankel had a triangular shape combustion architecture chamber, a piston chamber, and this one has got a hockey rink. It's sort of an oval rounded corner geometry. And whereas the Wankel could hardly achieve similar combustion pressures as an internal combustion engine and achieving efficient burn and low emissions, this one will achieve diesel combustion pressures and even photo detonation. And it will be a very clean burning and efficient engine. But the quasi-turbine fires four times in one revolution. So it's got eight times the impetus or pulse, input pulse, as our four-cycle combustion engine. And here you see all of the parts, and I think if you add those up, you've got 12 or 14 parts. And it will be very long-lasting, and at some point, very lightweight, and very cheap to build, and will run on anything from hairspray to fingernail polish to gasoline, Jet B, Jet A, diesel fuel, bunker seat, or biodiesel, or any of the above. And Stanley Myers water fuel cell, now alcohol is something that vested interest, I think it was J.P. Morgan again, this nefarious character, was involved in stopping the moonshiners. Henry Ford's Model A and Model T would run on alcohol, and eventually, as the hydrocarbon sector evolved, the alcohol as an alternative fuel disappeared. The moonshiners were running it, and in an earlier incarnation, I was a drag racer, and we built race cars, and I ran these in Edmonton, and the serious racing equipment ran on alcohol. So it's not like the power is there or is not there in alcohol. There's definitely a lot of fuel punch in a bottle of alcohol. The drag racers would achieve very high performance from this fuel, and it burns a lot cleaner than the normal hydrocarbon gasoline or diesel staple fuels. So this today, if you were to take a community small co-op approach or even a little rural farm community approach, for about a $20,000-$30,000 investment, you would be achieving 40-45 cents a gallon gasoline equivalent. So that's about 10-15 cents a liter. And I don't know how quickly the parasites out of Ottawa and Victoria would get in on the taxation, but I've given this a lot of thought, and even if I had to start a church and invited you all to join my church, as members of the church, you would be entitled to this fuel tax-free, if you get the drift. The tenets of the church would be community, integrity, and supporting free energy. So these are some of the idle thoughts that I have, but alcohol is one that's been... And we could always drink a little bit of it as well. So alcohol is a fuel that we could turn to very quickly. Brazil recently, or a few years back, looked at all of the clear-cutting of the Amazon and the rainforest, and they decided that they could grow sugarcane down there as a cash crop. So they just created a presidential edict or passed legislation and forced the car companies. If you want to sell cars in Brazil, you have to have a flex fuel capability and burn a high percentage alcohol from our sugarcane, or you don't get to sell cars. Well, they all complained and said it couldn't be done, but they were all doing it within 3 to 4 months. So don't let anybody tell you you cannot burn alcohol in your car. Most modern and new vehicles today will burn it without any retrofit and are classified as flex fuel vehicles, will burn a portion of it, 50%, 85%, or even 100%. The older V8 engines, I know from my racing days, all we had to do was fiddle a bit with the timing and the carburation, and that was all that was required to run these very high-performance, powerful race cars down the racetrack on alcohol. And it's an alternative that would break the stranglehold that the energy monopolies have, these OPEC and Halliburton energy interests that seem to want to wring every drop of blood and your firstborn child out of us here as hostage and ransom to these ridiculous fuel costs. I noticed this summer that when oil had achieved $147 a barrel, and we were paying here in the lower mainland somewhere in the $1.50 per liter, well, it's now gone down just recently, less than $38 a barrel, and is still 90 cents a liter. So this is a game, and it's time this game was put an end to. And alcohol is one of those alternative fuels that could be used by yourselves as individuals. A moonshine still is very basic technology. You can run it on wood. You can run it on whatever. You can burn blackstrap molasses and convert this. You can buy a tanker load of molasses very cheaply for feedstock. There's another technology in vertical greenhousing where they come up with an algae that they put through a bioreactor. It's plastic membranes. I don't know. The bioreactor sounds like something out of Star Wars, and it's like a nuclear control room. A bioreactor is a Ziploc bag with an algae floating through with the sun shining on it. This is basic stuff. And corn as a feedstock for biofuel or alcohol, ethanol or methanol, produces, I think, in the order of 70 or 150 gallons per acre, whereas this vertical greenhouse, because algae only starts to do its work with the photosynthesis at the top inch and a half of the pond, if you lay it all out vertically and let all that sunlight exposure surface area, you get some 30,000 gallons per acre. So these technologies are very basic. If the communities get together on these, they're well within your reach. And I said there was a price point of about 30, 40 cents a gallon for alcohol at a sort of a farm 25,000 price point horizon as far as a capital investment. So I've got a few web pages here that I'll draw your attention to, and you can make notes and visit these and learn more about them. Here's the Quasi Turbine, Mr. St. Laurent. That's the exact engine that I took out to UBC, where they didn't have the time to see it in the lab. And here's a little animation showing how this rotor piston architecture works. It has these rails that compress the gases in the corners of this thing and achieving photodetonation pressures or diesel compression ratios. Very clean, very efficient, and had General Motors jumped on this 3 to 4 years ago, they would be a profitable car company today, putting Toyota under the gun for innovation. So the solutions are out there. They've been stranded. They need your support to get them into the mix, if you would, the energy mix. This is Angel Labs with the MYT, the Mighty Engine. And you can see the inventor standing beside a very large diesel engine. And to achieve 800 foot-pounds of torque is indeed a mighty little engine. And you see it above the picture of the inventor there. And it's basically 14 inches in diameter. And to produce that amount of torque is just unbelievable. I had a 500 cubic inch engine in an old Cadillac, a collector's car, a 500 cubic inch engine putting out, I think, 265 foot-pounds of torque. This old car was about 5,000-6,000 pounds. It had a lot of power. So you could imagine 800 foot-pounds of torque coming out of a very small device here. So Angel Labs is an inventor with a product, a prototype, in development, and if they had the support, they too could get out there and make a difference very quickly. And this is David Blooms. He sells books on how you can retrofit your vehicle to run on alcohol, and there's also little adapter kits if your car is not flex fuel ready, where with very small minor modifications can run readily cleaner than gasoline or diesel products, and alcohol could be a fuel that would put a lot of agricultural land into production. So this was a fuel that was used for many years at the early part of the century, and for vested interest, political reasons, was taken off the fuel mix, if you would, and we went on to petrol and gasoline, and then eventually on to unleaded. And alcohol is still burned in race cars today. The top Indy cars are burning alcohol. A lot of the top fuel dragsters burn alcohol or nitrous with alcohol. And it can run, and you see them every day on the streets of Rio de Janeiro and Brazil, where these cars are very clean, running with a lot of horsepower and torque. So these solutions are out there, and the so-called authorities tell us that there are no solutions and that we just have to suck it up and pay these $1.50 a liter exorbitant prices, ransoming your first child, if you would.
That's all the time we have this week. You have been listening to a talk by Martin Berger, Find his website at www.blueenergy.com and check out newenergymovement.ca for more ideas. This recording was made by Alex Smith in Vancouver on January 26, 2009. Thank you so much for donating your time and your brain. What do you think? Will tidal power run the next civilization?